The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. As even your tireless Skeptically Speaking team needs a break once in a while, and as our guest is a very busy man, this episode is pre-recorded, and we are therefore not taking audience questions. Enjoy the interview, and happy holidays. I'm here with Joe Nickel, the world's only full-time professional paranormal investigator. He's a writer for Skeptical Inquirer magazine and the author of many, many books, such as Crime Science, Methods of Forensic Detection, Camera Clues, A Handbook for Photographic Investigation, and Relics of the Christ. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
So how long have you been a skeptical investigator?
Well, it certainly began after my belief in Santa Claus was finally ended. I had a grandmother who kept me believing in Santa Claus. She would rub soot on the letters so they appeared to come down the chimney. One writer said this was obviously my introduction to forensic science. I've been investigating seriously since, I would say, 1969, when I sat in my first seance to contact the spirit of Houdini. And that's been, 41 years ago?
Well, according to my count, you've written 25 books. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know. I think probably it's more than that, but it depends on whether you count my little chapbooks of poetry or some of my little local history books and so forth. But it's obviously at least 19 too many.
People would beg to disagree.
I invite them to.
Well, there's an interesting bit on your website. You say, in contrast to mystery mongers on the one hand and so-called debunkers on the other, I believe that mysteries should actually be investigated with a view towards solving them. Can you explain that statement?
Well, it's the detective's approach. We would not like it if a lieutenant sitting in the police station had the sergeant come running in and say, Lieutenant, there's been a shooting across town. We would not want the lieutenant to say, oh yes, probably just another suicide. The sergeant might say, but sir, he was shot 3 times in the back. We wouldn't want the lieutenant to say, oh, it's a very bad case of suicide. We want our forensic people, our crime solvers, to actually solve crimes, to go to the scene of the crime. And we want real investigation. We don't want people saying, oh, it's probably just another suicide. No, no, we want actual real-world investigative work. So my view is, if we decry the true believer who just rushes to believe in something for which there's little evidence, then we must criticize the skeptic who styles himself or herself as a debunker and seems to know the answer to something before ever making any inquiry. It's not only intellectually dishonest to do that, it isn't smart, because the best you can do in saying of the next haunted house you hear about, the best you can do is say, well, it's not a ghost. Well, maybe it isn't, but what is it? What is causing some unusual phenomena? Like my first case, hearing footsteps on the stairs when no one was in the house and the house was locked. Okay, it's not a ghost, maybe. What's the explanation? And if the answer is, well, I don't care, it doesn't interest me if it's not a ghost, I mean, how do you even try to prove a negative in that case? You really can't prove there aren't ghosts, so you're really just sort of stating disbelief as if it's a kind of faith. The only way to honestly arrive at knowledge is to investigate, and then you know whereof you speak. And so I advocate that we actually suspend such conceptions of the answer, not begin with the answer and work backwards to the evidence, but actually begin with the evidence and see where it leads and believe that. And if we investigate something and solve a mystery, we don't need to set out to debunk. If I can explain something, the explanation will surely debunk it if it needs debunking. So if I can say that, for example, my ghost on the stairs, that the sound of those footsteps, which I was able to do, were coming from the building next door with a staircase against the adjacent wall about 40 inches away, then I have explained that case, And of course it is debunked, the ghost is debunked at the same time. But otherwise, just to shout at someone and call them a fool for believing in ghosts is not, doesn't explain anything, and it's not a scientific approach. Science doesn't start with an answer and then work backwards to the evidence. So you go and you just want to find out what's so. And you're skeptical of everything on all sides until you get some good data that's convincing.
So now you investigate everything from Bigfoot to Jack the Ripper's diary, but also religious artifacts. Are the methods similar?
The methods are very similar if you investigate things that are investigatable. I don't really go out to investigate God. I don't know how to investigate God any better than I know how to investigate leprechauns. I'm certainly skeptical of both. But when you tell me that God has caused some supernatural event, some physical event, like caused a statue to weep, well, now I can examine that empirical claim. Or someone says the Shroud of Turin is a, you know, the burial cloth of Jesus. That's something that we could look at in the same way we would look at any other historical artifact and bring to bear the methods of science. So I investigate empirical claims, not just some idea in someone's head, but if there is some actual tangible thing. Now, the difference between, let's say, investigating a haunted house and investigating the Jack the Ripper diary. The debunker type is probably right when he comes to the ghost in saying, whatever it is, it's not a ghost. It appears to be what all the scientific investigators have found. So if you were a betting person, just betting on the odds, you could pretty well, you know, in a closed-minded way, just say, well, it's not a ghost. But you can't get by with that with a question document because, hey, someone has a George Washington letter or a Jack the Ripper diary. How would you know? There are certainly fake George Washington letters and genuine George Washington letters. So because I do this other work in questioned historical documents, I can't afford there to have a prejudgment. I've handled both genuine and fake Abraham Lincolns, you know, with some seriousness and had them under my stereo microscope and had major clients wanting my opinion. And I have to actually say in this case what the evidence is and what the judgment is. I can't afford to just say, well, whatever it is, you know, it isn't a ghost. But if you follow my reasoning on how we should look at ghosts, I really apply the same thing there. Whatever we investigate, we should not start with the answer, but whenever a genuine question has been fairly raised, we need to actually suspend judgment until we have looked at the facts. I'm quite convinced that that's the right approach, but I know that there are a lot of skeptics out there who will say things like, oh, well, how many haunted houses do you have to go into before you realize there are no ghosts? And I say to them, well, if the question is just, are there ghosts or are there not? Again, I think there are not. And I've probably been in more haunted houses than any of those people asking the question, maybe more than any 10 or 20 of them. But I don't think that's the question. I think the question is this. Do people believe there are ghosts in haunted houses? And the answer is yes, they do, in large numbers. And do they claim to have some kind of evidence, orbs in photographs or something? And are they getting misleading a lot of other people with this? Yes, they are. There's no question that that's so. You only have to turn on your TV set to see that that's so. So what I'm saying is, how do we deal with that? If I just say, oh, they're stupid, you know, they're probably drunk or they're liars or something, which is what, believe me, a lot of debunkers end up saying or implying something like that all the time, and they don't know what they're talking about. It may be a perfectly sincere person with some real evidence. The best way to deal with these things, I think, is to know whereof you speak by actually investigating it and pointing out what you find. And not everybody will believe you then. That's true. But you may convince some reasonable and intelligent people and make some gains. That's what I'm about.
Well, you've really produced a massive body of work, especially around Christian relics. So why those?
The Christian relics, and more specifically even Catholic out of those, I have the relics. Methodists don't have relics. So there is not a cult of relics. I don't mean to be picking on the Catholics. they have all the great relics like the Shroud of Turin and the pieces of the True Cross and so forth, or relics of saints like the blood of San Gennaro. So if I'm accused of picking on Catholics, I plead, well, they have these claims in huge numbers. If the Methodists start up, I will go after them. And if the Catholics stop canonizing saints for working, quote, miracles, I will probably lay off them.
Well, you have looked into non-Christian relics, and I guess maybe not relics. I'm thinking specifically of the Nazca lines.
Across 30 miles of desert pampas in Peru are these gigantic outline drawings of birds and spiders and monkeys and so forth that can only really be made sense of from the air, say at 1,000 feet. The lines on the ground, if you're standing on the ground, they just appear to go this way and that. Because, for example, the condor is 440 feet long. It's the length and a half of a football field. So it's a real phenomenon. It only crosses our skeptics' radar screen because of outrageous claims made on behalf of the Nazca lines. Claims that sell short the people who surely made them, the ancient Nazca indigenous people. Claims by Erich von Däniken in his book Chariots of the Gods that because it would be so hard, he imagined, to make these giant drawings without surveying equipment or something sophisticated. Therefore, it must have been extraterrestrials who came to the planet Earth and beamed down instructions to the awed savages, as von Däniken seems to picture them. It's ludicrous, as are von Däniken's claims generally, that ancient astronauts came to Earth and mated with our ancestors to produce modern man. But the Nazca lines remain, and they are a genuine mystery. We don't know exactly how they were made, or more importantly, why they were made. Though I think now we have a lot better information than we did when I first started this many years ago. And I have contributed quite a bit, I think, to these issues. Though I didn't know or suspect even that there was a religious angle until somewhat later. It's not obvious that the Nazca lines are religious because the figures are just birds and monkeys and so forth. But as we proceed to investigate, we learn things and gain some knowledge. People have occasionally said that I showed how the Nazca drawings were made. Now, I've not claimed that. What I did was to say, in response to people like von Däniken, that maybe the ancient peoples were smarter than von Däniken thought they were. And so I set about to use simple sticks and string to reproduce these giant figures. And I made the giant condor, 440 feet long, using a crew of about five or six people, and doing it in a couple of days. And Scientific American magazine said that my recreation was, quote, remarkable in its exactness to the original. So some have rushed to say that I showed how they did it. No, I showed a way that you could use simple methods such as they might have used. And I have, since that time, made another giant Nazca figure, this one the giant spider, which is much smaller, for National Geographic television. They sort of begged me to come out of retirement. I'm one of the world's only giant geoglyph makers, and they wanted me to make one, and I said, oh, please don't make me do that. I've already made one, and so forth. And they said, yes, but you didn't film it. You only took photos. And so, okay, they got me a ranch out in California with a big flat stretch of land, and they got a cherry picker, one of those lift trucks, and stuck a camera way up in the air. I had a couple of helpers, and in a day I made the giant spider and became Spider-Man. I used an even simpler method. I won't go into describing those, but basically these are pretty simple approaches, and they don't require any measurement of angles or any sophisticated surveying equipment or really knowledge of any particular kind, but simply use a small drawing and enlarge from it. You need some kind of unit of measurement. But even that, I'm inclined to think now that I could almost dispense with that. And my thinking gets simpler as the years go by. Not to take credit away from the Nazca people, but rather to give them more credit that they deserve. And so your other question, or the other issue, was the religious aspect, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I found was the Nazca drawings have a couple of pretty striking features. They're all drawn with one continuous line, as if you put your pencil down on this giant sketch pad, and without lifting the pencil, you trace the outline of the figure with all its ins and outs and so forth till you got back to the beginning. As opposed to the normal way we draw, and the way the Nazcas do on their pottery, you draw a head, say, and lift your brush, and draw a wing and lift your brush. And this continuous line is striking. It's a striking effect of the figures. I thought in my youth, well, it's just because they're plotting points, which is sort of what I'm doing in making my giant drawing, and then it's just connecting them as they go. And I still think that's not a bad hypothesis. But now we know another fact. We know that most of the figures have a pair of extra lines that don't have anything to do with the anatomy of the figure. They're not layout lines or guidelines or anything you can figure. They're just these extra lines. For example, the spider from its lower right leg has two parallel lines that just go off at a right angle for a distance. The monkey has two parallel lines that go up to the base of the tail. The hummingbird appears not to have two parallel lines, but then you realize the beak is the pair of parallel lines. But you can see how this goes. If you had the pictures before you, you would see that these two factors are very stunning. So that when you put them together, you start somewhere in one of the lines, and you keep going, and you will trace the entire figure and come out the other line. And this hit me like a ton of bricks at some point. I don't claim that I'm the first person to realize this, but it sure got me when it did, and I've done some writing to make the case for this. And so I believe if you look at the figures on the ground, and I've been to Peru, I've looked at the Nazca figures, I've flown over them, and I've been out in the desert, and these drawings, the lines themselves are like footpaths. The desert is littered with a sort of darkish, reddish gravel. If you pick that gravel up, take it away, you leave a light-colored, yellowish earth. And so the lines are made by subtracting the gravel and leaving a blank footpath. If you just swept away the gravel to the bare earth, and it's about the width of a convenient walking path. And so when you put now that third factor with those first two that I mentioned, you just have, I think, really profound evidence that these are ritual walking paths, beyond which I can only kind of, Sherlock Holmes said, don't guess, because guessing is destructive to the logical faculty. So I'm not going to say I guess, but I deduce with some evidence that these are ritual walking paths, and that the most likely purpose of them, the ritual, would be to invoke the spirits, maybe the spirits in the sky or something, probably to invoke rain, to bring water, which was the one thing the Nazcas were desperate for. These are walking paths. They're not just something you would do as a novelty or something. They would have required a huge amount of work over centuries of time. Apparently, some of them kind of, the lines overlap, and there are a lot of lines other than the figures, long straight lines that go ruler straight for miles. So these have to do with processions or walking in a ritual way.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm discussing religious artifacts with Joe Nickel, paranormal investigator and prolific author. And this is a pre-recorded episode, so please don't call in. We're not in the booth. So let's get into Christian artifacts. Maybe we'll start with the blood of San Gennaro.
San Gennaro, or in English, St. Januarius, is probably a fictitious figure. He probably didn't exist. The church no longer officially recognizes him. But nevertheless, in Naples Cathedral, there are a couple of vials of what are said to be St. Januarius's blood. One of them is pretty much dried up and defunct, but there is one vial of quote-unquote blood, and it's set in a monstrance, a kind of reliquary with glass faces, so you can actually see light coming from the other side, for example, and you can see that it's, if you shine a light from the back, it's red and looks rather like blood. And it has this amazing property. From time to time, when they get it out on special occasions, and they want the blood to do the miracle so that everything will be well, this blood mysteriously liquefies. Now, real blood, once it's coagulated, cannot do that. It's coagulated and it will eventually dry up and turn brown and then blacken with age and so forth, but not the quote-unquote blood of San Gennaro, who supposedly was martyred, and his blood, someone thought to collect his blood. It's a very unlikely sort of situation. One of those pious legends that has no real evidence for it, just is told and retold.
Right.
But the blood does liquefy. So my forensic friend, John Fisher, and I set to work to try to investigate that phenomenon. Naturally, people aren't allowed to open the vial and subject it to forensic tests. We would have been happy to do that. But we were able to try to produce something that simulated it. If you read about the phenomenon prior to my involvement, you'll see people talk about how skeptics failed. They tried all sorts of concoctions and things. They could never produce this miracle by trickery. Well, we did. We were able to make a substance. I'll give you just the gist of it. We used olive oil and in it a little bit of beeswax. And we did this by heating them up so that they were hot and the beeswax was melted, and these two substances then are miscible. And we were able to put in by test, you know, first a drop of the beeswax and then two drops and so forth until we reached a state, and then we colored it with blood-colored pigment, all available in the 14th century. And we were able to reach a state in which, once this solution was kept and sealed and then had completely cooled and was at a sort of cool room temperature, it would be congealed. There was enough beeswax to cause that to happen. But if I pick it up in my hand and hold it for a moment, just the body heat will warm it and it will miraculously liquefy. And the Januarian phenomenon, we think that candles on the altar, the proximity of people, the body heat, and so forth, might be just enough when it's removed from its cool storage area to the church. It might be enough to cause it to warm up and the miracle take place. We were just ready to publish our findings on this when our Italian friends, they came in with a different hypothesis. They had made some miracle blood as a thixotropic gel. That is, it's a kind of a chemical concoction that is congealed at rest, but if you shake it vigorously, say, it thins out and becomes liquid.
Right.
Examples would be non-drip paint and maybe tomato ketchup.
Did they have that in the 14th century?
Well, this was our question. Our friend's position was that the materials they used were available. Our question was, yeah, but was the concept there? Of course, well, somebody could have just invented it or discovered it by some accident. It's not at all impossible. Certainly far more likely than that it was miraculous. Anyway, they just beat us with their hypothesis as far as publicity. We were just whipped. They got in the journal Nature, the science journal Nature, and got headlines, newspapers around the world, and we sulked. We just went off quietly and sulked. And it was kind of devastating because we had spent 2.5 years on our phenomenon, but we rallied, and I wrote about this in one of my books, and I told about our work and why we weren't necessarily convinced that theirs was the right answer. Just as we said, we went from having no hypothesis to having two very good ones, and all good for the cause of skepticism. We need to show that, yes, this could be easily made because there's evidence of trickery, and I'll sort of get to. But nevertheless, we sort of sulked a bit and everything, and some time went by, and we heard that our Italian friends, some of the vials of this gel that they made had sort of quit working, and we didn't think that was a good sign for them because the St. Januarian one was still working very, very well. We knew ours would work well for centuries. And so we waited and we waited, and then one of our Italian friends, Luigi Garlaschelli, a dear friend of mine, and he and I have worked on A Shroud of Turin and other issues since, he was able to get access, not to the famous vial, but to another one that did the same trick or feat. There are actually several of these, all in the sort of general Naples area, sort of like there was some local trick going on some centuries ago, and the knowledge was sort of known in that area how to do this. Doesn't sound so much like a real miracle. It's too regional and too fraught with difficulty to think that it's other than a trick. Anyway, he got access to this one on condition that he not harm it in any way. He could do non-destructive tests. So he first decided to test his and his friend's hypothesis of thixotropy. So he took the vial and he agitated it, and nothing happened. And then he decided to test our hypothesis, and he warmed it slightly, whereupon a miracle occurred, and we were very happy. And that's sort of where the state is now. Well, if we seem a little gleeful, it's only fair because we had to sulk, you know, for all that time. All in the interest of science, and we're all good friends and so forth, and but, you know, when you've worked really, really hard on something, there is a little bit of competitiveness, and you don't like being whipped.
Understandable.
So right now, we're feeling a little better about it, and a final point that they've made is that, of course, none of us knows exactly what's in the vial. And so we don't know that this vial that was tested is exactly the same formulation as the Januarian one.
Mm-hmm.
One could be thixotropic, another an oil wax emulsion like ours, another one something else. But I'm just going to opt for Occam's razor, that simple principle that, you know, if there's no reason to think otherwise, just use the simplest explanation. And I'm going to think they're all probably working on the same principle, and that the most likely suggestion that it's in the oil wax family. There even may be some waxes that themselves are just the right mixture. And there's precedent for this in the 14th century, in that artists were using oil wax emulsions in some of their work. So not unheard of that someone could have been fiddling around with such things, you see. And artists would have been making various concoctions of blood for paintings and so forth. And we're thinking that the blood of San Gennaro is probably not a miracle.
Well, this is really one of the problems with a lot of your research, is that it's so hard for you to get your hands on the piece that you're researching at all.
Absolutely, and I'm glad you brought that up. That's a really good insight into the whole realm of this stuff, because some of it would be pretty straightforward. The Shroud of Turin is eminently testable, and, you know, I called for years for it to be carbon dated, and finally it was carbon dated. Give science a vial of blood and let it open the vial. There are ways to open and take out samples of things and do very little destruction and so forth. Now, we can tell if blood is blood. So some of these matters could be very straightforward if they weren't sort of hiding behind the protection of religion.
I was going to use the phrase shrouded in secrecy.
Well, it's
I'm
so
sorry.
I'm certainly forgiven for doing it. Most of us have used some version of that, talking about the shroud. But point well taken. So what I have to do, and this happens to me quite a bit, Weeping Statue up in Windsor, Ontario, presently, you know, I have a standing offer. If they'll let me have custody of the weeping icon, and I predict that it will cease to weep.
Let's talk about that statue, because that's quite recent.
It's very recent. It is, as far as I know, still this moment on exhibit in a Maronite Roman Catholic church, and it started out at the home of a Orthodox Christian woman, and what happened was she was claiming to have visions and a whole bunch of stuff. She claimed to have stigmata, like markings on her body, the letter M for Mary and so forth. Pretty soon she got some donations, and someone donated a statue, and then, don't you know, the statue began to weep oil, and don't you know, the oil had healing properties, and, you know, she became a sort of walking litany of miracle claims. And unfortunately, the neighbors complained of people blocking traffic and creating a nuisance, and the city council ordered her to move the statue, and eventually found a home in this Catholic church. But her church is Orthodox Christian, and her priest was very doubtful of all of this and said so, that the Orthodox did not believe in weeping statues.
Right.
He could have gone on to say, though, that they do sometimes believe in weeping icons. The Roman and Orthodox churches both had icons, that is, painted wood panels, and the Orthodox never got into statues.
Well, the reports say that she smiles during the day and she weeps tears of healing oil at night. So how would you investigate that?
Well, if I went there, and what I did in this case, because I know I give the impression otherwise, I'm just one little person. I can't be everywhere. I can't investigate every one of those tens of thousands of haunted and miracle places. In this case, I simply used the research from this site. It was tipped off by one of my Facebook friends. I got a call from the Toledo Blade, and they shared some information and so forth. And so I know a lot about what's happening there, what's alleged to happen there, and so forth. And I certainly have an opinion. More could be done, and I am offering publicly that I would do more, but I would have to be allowed a free hand. What I would want to do is to take it into my custody. That will end all discussions of whether someone's slipping in at night, as some have publicly suggested, been putting oil on the statue. Such trickery we could talk about is rampant. I suspect that the statue's expression never changes. I've heard that claimed in other statues, and there's no evidence for it. People can subjectively feel that a picture changes expression. She has a hint of a smile, and her brows may seem a little bit sad. You put the two together, and depending on how you look at it, it might look smiling one time and sad another or something. In any case, I think you could also just make the case of what people are saying is that an otherwise smiling statue then cries. But
interesting.
It doesn't really change expression, I think. I don't know if someone's saying that it literally does, but they would have to show some proof of that. And it's not for me to disprove something. It's certainly not until that's been established. Skeptics have a saying, before you try to explain something, make sure it really happened. There are just great stories of skeptics, you know, waxing eloquent to explain something, going way, way, way out on a limb, only to find out, in the words of Gilda Radner, never mind. Didn't happen.
Well, could this be a naturally occurring happening at all? The oil, specifically.
It's unlikely to be. One always wants to try to explain something as a mistake rather than a deliberate deception, and I do so out of my humanistic sense of kindness, and also for good legal reasons. We shouldn't accuse someone of something if we don't need to. So there have been statues where maybe some rainwater on an outdoor statue, or in one case, bird droppings, yes, and so on. Maybe in one case of a wooden statue that had glass eyes, maybe moisture preferentially condensed on the glass eyes, as they would on a glass of water, and supposedly wept. And this could be a perfectly natural phenomenon. Oil, not so easy to explain. Oil on a Greek Orthodox icon, I've seen one where that could have been accidentally splashed on because they have oil lamps hanging in front of them. And you could knock one against the icon and splash oil on it. Then it would look like splashed oil and not like neat trickles coming from the eyes, right?
Right.
So The devil's in the details. I've been in homes that had a number of these oil-exuding figures, and you can see that in some cases the oil didn't even come out of the tear ducts. They were carelessly placed above the eye or something.
Right.
One woman in Italy was caught using a squirt gun to apply liquid.
Really?
Oh, yes, really. In another case in Quebec, a man had statues that were exuding blood, and people would actually see the blood sort of freshly flow. That's rarely the case. Usually it's static. You just see some oil on it, and it's not freshly flowing. But in this case, what he had done after tests showed that the blood was mixed with animal fat, and he confessed, he had put this mixture on, and of course, as pilgrims would crowd into his home, their body heat would warm the room up, and then it would work sort of like the blood of San Gennaro. And the animal fat would liquefy a bit and thin out, and then it would trickle. A very powerful effect, apparently. Another case that I know of in, I believe, Sardinia, the blood proved to have the DNA the same as that of the woman who owned the statue.
Interesting.
And, of course, you could draw the proper skeptical conclusion there. Although her attorney said, well, the Virgin Mary has to get the blood from somewhere.
Oh.
Yes, kind of hard to argue with that logic, isn't it? So my point is that we don't have any natural explanations, really, for oil coming out of a plaster statue. And we have it coming from someone who's got markings on her. So the simplest explanation is that all of these are pious deceptions. And the more things that happen centered around one person, the less it seems like a bunch of natural occurrences of some bizarre nature.
Right.
And more like a common deception. So I just say I can't distinguish this case from a pious fraud. I do offer to take custody, and I have a little icon here that once wept in Syria, and the BBC gave it to me. You'll be shocked to hear this, I'm sure. As soon as the BBC got it, it quit weeping. And when the BBC producer gave it to me, it was no longer weeping. And I've had it now, lo, these many, many years, and I have told it sad stories. I have sliced onions in front of it. It just will not weep for me.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm talking with author and investigator Joe Nickel about religious relics. And again, this is a pre-recorded episode, which means we're not taking questions this evening. We'll return to our live programming on January 7th, and we'll be right back after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we ring in the new year with an interview for those of us who prefer a good book, a quiet chat, or an interesting hour of radio over a night of wild partying. We're joined by Dr. Marty Laney, family therapist and author of The Introvert's Advantage, to learn why some people are wired to prefer solitude and how they can learn to navigate in a world that rewards people who love to socialize. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm joined today by Joe Nickel, professional paranormal investigator, historical document consultant, author, and the muse for the protagonist of the 2007 horror film, The Reaping, or so says Wikipedia. Is that true?
Yes, I didn't know that was in Wikipedia.
It is.
Under what entry?
Under your name, actually.
Well, I should check up and see what they're saying about me, shouldn't I? I'm sure every word is true. But, yes, The Reaping, starring Hilary Swank.
That's the one.
I first heard about something going on when a scriptwriter from Hollywood called me and wanted to talk about my work and so forth, and particularly the religious miracles investigator part. And we talked, and we had various arguments, and I tried to distinguish myself from a debunker, as you know, how I've labored to do that, and so forth. Then I didn't hear anything for a while, and we realized here somebody was getting some back issues of our magazines, and so I think Barry Carr contacted and wanted to know what they were doing and maybe suggested my book or something. They said, oh, we have bought several copies of Joe's Looking for a Miracle, and Hillary is reading it right now, and so on. So we began to think, oh, well, gee, what's going on here? And eventually Warner Brothers invited me down to St. Francisville, Louisiana, and I was on this set and watched some of the filming. One day I met Hori Swank, who's a very bright and engaging person, and spent some quality time with her, and just generally had a good time. And then the movie came out, and my wife and I were watching this movie, which was, you know, loosely based on the work I do. A little different thing, more of a debunker and so forth. And we watched 5 or 10 minutes of this. It's not too bad, you know. And all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose. You know, the biblical plagues are revisited on the Louisiana bayou, and blood and frogs are raining from the air. And my wife leaned over in the movie theater and said, "You never told me about this." And we started laughing, and the movie went on from there. It didn't last long. This was in and out of the theaters quickly, but it didn't hurt me very much. But, you know, it was I argued with the scriptwriter, and I said at some point, I said, "I know what you're going to do. The skeptic is going to find something he can't explain and convert, right?" And he said, "Yeah, this is Hollywood." Yeah, and I said, "Well, you might as well just ask me to shoot myself in the foot for all the good this will do me." So I have developed something of a philosophical attitude about some of this stuff. And they're going to do stuff anyway. I do the best I can to restrain them a bit or have some input. A little skepticism is better than none at all.
I agree completely.
And I have suffered great amounts of abuse, for which I'm hoping someday to get PsyCop's coveted Award of Valor.
Well,
no proof that there is such an award.
Let's talk about something that you've actually taken quite a lot of abuse on. You wrote an entire book on the Shroud of Turin, Inquest on the Shroud of Turin, Latest Scientific Findings. So give us some background.
My first real serious book, and my first book other than a little book of poems. The Shroud of Turin, supposedly the burial cloth of Jesus, a 14-foot length of linen cloth, bearing what looks like the imprints of a apparently crucified man, having the markings of wound in the side and so forth of Jesus, pierced hands and feet. And arrayed on this long piece of cloth, as if you're seeing the front of the figure and then arrayed with it head to head, the back of the figure. It's as if someone lay down on one end of the cloth, and then the cloth were brought up and over the head and then draped down the front of the person. And the image was photographed in 1898, whereupon the photographer discovered that when he was looking at his glass plate negatives, the image looked much more lifelike, and eventually realized that it looks more like a positive image on the negative plates. But the question was then asked, how is it possible that some medieval artist could have produced a perfect negative image centuries before the invention of photography?
Right.
Well, it seems impossible, and so once again, the miraculists have snookered us with a bogus question. Because first of all, it isn't a perfect photographic negative. It's nothing of the sort. It's a quasi-negative. It has some negative and some positive qualities. For example, when you look at the reversed image that looks positive, the hair and beard are white, which, unless you think Jesus was an albino or an elderly white-bearded man, doesn't make any sense. So it's partly positive and partly negative. And the answer of all that, as I showed in my experiments, just exactly such quasi-negativity is produced if you do a rubbing from a bas-relief. And so I began to produce face-only images and showed how an artist might have produced such a cloth. The time period, we imagine, the middle of the 14th century, is actually indicated by the earliest document that mentions the shroud, and that's a report from Bishop Pierre Darcy to Pope Clement VII, dating 1389, and he is saying, basically, to paraphrase a bit, "Holy Father, let me tell you what's going on in my diocese, why there was this fake shroud that they had years ago, and my predecessor dealt with it, and why they were hiring people to pretend that they were sick, and then this fake shroud would be revealed to them, and they would pretend that they were cured, so that, as he said, money might be cunningly wrung from the pockets of unsuspecting pilgrims. And he went on to say that it had surfaced again, and he was trying to deal with it, and it's quite beside himself with anger. And this Darcy memorandum is the earliest known report on this questioned cloth. Now, we have to back up a little and realize that the Gospel of John details how Jesus was buried with multiple cloths, a shroud with a separate cloth over the face, and tying and binding. And this is just not consistent in any way, really, with the Shroud of Turin. So fundamentalists are often anti-shroud because they prefer to have their gospel rather than this questionable cloth.
Interesting.
But Roman Catholics may be inclined, although, of course, there are many, many enlightened Roman Catholic skeptics of the Shroud of Turin. But there's a sort of little cult within the church that all but worships the Shroud of Turin, and their eyes glaze over when they mention the blood, and they just have this vacant expression.
Well, there was a secret commission to investigate it at one point, wasn't there?
There was, and it's one of many scandals. They secretly examined the shroud. To their credit, they had some experts. They had an art expert. They had a couple of forensic serologists. And they were good Catholics, but they were basically scientists and experts first, and then Catholics after. And the local authorities were doing this, the Turin Church authorities, and they lied and said that they didn't have such a study when it was first reported, and later had to kind of backpedal, and there's a lot of a scandal there. But the blood was not blood. It failed basically all the tests for blood. And they found traces of what appeared to be paint. And unfortunately, they were not dealt with very well. They were called all sorts of names and treated pretty shabbily. And so the earliest tests were not favorable to the shroud. And then there was the Shroud of Turin Research Project, and they, with a lot of brouhaha, went over. And turns out, of course, that the leaders of this group were on the executive council of the Holy Shroud Guild. So we had the shroud cultists. None of them had any expertise as forensic serologists or anything to test paintings and so forth. But they did have one scientist who got their samples who they were going to give to do the tests as an independent tester, and that's the famous microanalyst Walter McCrone. And he identified red ochre and vermilion pigments in a tempera binder in the blood area. So the image and the blood areas were done with paint. And for his efforts, he was shabbily treated, his samples confiscated. I remember when I had some secret knowledge of what he had found, and the shroud people were putting out a report claiming that they had found no evidence of forgery or artistry. And a reporter, a well-known reporter, contacting me, and she said, well, they're claiming that there's no evidence of artistry. And I remember thinking, okay, how do you counter that and at the same time keep your word that you will not repeat what you've been told? I first said, that's not true. And then I said, remember this, that the secret commission found all sorts of red granules that wouldn't even dissolve in reagents that dissolve blood. And finally I said, so all of this is consistent with, let's say, something like red ochre tempera paint. So I didn't say, now I've been told. I thought it was a pretty good job in trying to get out the truth while handcuffed, straitjacketed, and hanging upside down from a tall building. Anyway, eventually, McCrone's secrecy agreement expired, and he was able to come forward, and of course, he did a wonderful book called Judgment Day for the Turin Shroud, and you can see with your own eyes the photomicrographs of the particles of pigment and the pigment medium agglomerates and the microchemical tests and the results. Of course, the pro-shroud people who've started with the answer have explanations for everything I've said. The Gospels could be mistaken, the bishop's report trumped up, he's jealous, something like that. So we throw away the forger's confession, that's hearsay anyway.
So they're not actually trying to argue with the science necessarily, though?
Well, they have argued with the science, but you see, they start with the answer. So when the science is damning, they try to find scientific sounding arguments why that could be a mistake.
Right.
Maybe they got false results, or something could look like something else. Red ochre, that's red iron oxide. Maybe there's some rust got on the shroud. And so the public was misled time and time and time again. And I don't say it's, you know, in all cases it was a deliberate fraud or something. There were some actually fraudulent science involved in the Shroud Turn. The guy who claimed to have found pollens, nobody else could figure out how he found these pollens. They weren't on anybody else's tape samples. They made no scientific sense. But Macrone got a hold of those samples, and turns out that the pollens weren't on that guy's tapes either. And so that was another scandal. But a lot of pseudoscience and a lot of science that starts with the answer, and just to sort of finish up some of the evidence, and that is the radiocarbon dating. I predicted, of course, in my book, practically the month the Shroud of Turin was made. That's an exaggeration. Based on the forger's confession, in other words, we're dating the shroud pretty much to the time of the forger's confession. And then, finally, radiocarbon dating was done, and it was done blind, and it was done under the auspices of the famous British Museum, and samples were taken by textile experts, identified an area free of contamination, and, you know, samples were snipped out of end of the shroud, and then they used samples of burial cloths of known dates. And in these three different laboratories did the tests, and in each case, they all hit right on the money on the control samples. Then they turned to the Shroud of Turin. And they all got age ranges in such a close agreement that it was like three archers hitting the bullseye with three arrows. They were just very, very close. And, of course, the halfway period between the dates was about the time that Macrone and I had been saying the shroud was made. Well, it was a devastating blow to the Shroudies, and they just, you know, were silent for a while. Some of them were chagrined. Their world was sort of crumbling. But then they all seemed to recover and to rally. And somebody had started a rumor that those stupid scientists had tested some sort of repair patch or something, and that would explain everything. Whew. Wasn't true, but they were back in the business, and maybe Jesus's radiance at the moment of his resurrection had altered the carbon ratio.
Ah.
Well, some people said, well, that's not science. That's, well, okay, maybe not everybody will buy that. How about during the fire of 1532, the fire altered the carbon ratio? Well, never mind that they'd allowed for all these things. And just one new claim after another to explain away the carbon dating. So pretty soon they could explain everything, because they started with an absolute belief. So if the blood chemistry or the carbon dating or the historical record didn't fit with that, it had to be wrong. Whereas people like me were simply saying, well, on the face of it, the gospel evidence, the historical record, is devastating. The documentary evidence of the forger's confession, because the bishop actually said in his memorandum, the truth being attested by the artist who painted it.
Whew.
So it's actually a reference to confessed forger. But, of course, since he's not named, and you could technically call that hearsay, but if you just look at it on the face of it, you could see that it looks like it's not blood. It looks like the blood is actually tempera paint. No burial cloth in the history of the world has left such a neat imprint. And in fact, you can coat yourself with rouge and make an imprint. I've done this test with the most critical area of the face, and you'll get grotesque wraparound distortions. So how could such a neat, too good to be true, too picture-like, the blood doesn't look like real blood that's soaked into the cloth and spangled and run among the fibers. It looks like it's been painted in neat little trickles that have somehow magically levitated onto the cloth. But they can get a Shroudy who, they've got people in all fields that, you know, have joined their club and who will say, this is science.
Well, do you think there's ever going to be any amount of evidence that's going to convince people that maybe their conclusions aren't valid?
I think it'd be very difficult. They want to keep picking and choosing among the evidence. Some of them want new carbon dating tests because maybe something will be different, or they can get some discrepancy and just throw out all the carbon dating then or something. And they've got nowhere to go. But my own personal view now is that science has proved the Shroud of Turin is a 14th century forgery. And I know some people disagree with that, but that is the mainstream science view. And to keep pretending that it's just a controversy and science is unsure. And then they're arguing, like so much of the paranormal, they're arguing from ignorance. They're saying, we don't know what caused this, therefore it must be a miracle. Well, this is a logical fallacy called an argument from ignorance. And the ghost people do it, the flying saucer people do it. We don't know what the noise in the old house was, so it must be a ghost. We don't know what the bright light in the sky was, therefore it must be a flying saucer from another planet. Well, these are illogical claims. You can't say, I don't know, therefore I do know. It's a logical fallacy, and yet miracle claims, including all of the healings from Lourdes, that's exactly how they're predicated. We don't know why this cancer went into remission, therefore it's a miracle of the Holy Virgin Mary. In that case, I'm glad to report that the Lourdes Medical Bureau, the doctors who used to certify these very few cases, actually, as being medically inexplicable, has quit playing that game. Said it was not scientific and they're not doing it anymore. The doctors have quit.
So there's progress.
There is progress. And what we skeptics can do is ourselves quit being like the people we criticize, suspend judgment, look for the best evidence, be creative, try to find clever strategies for how to attack a problem, and then put your work out saying, here's what I think and why, and I believe this is the simplest, most scientific explanation, and let people have at you.
Joe, these investigations are fascinating, and we can't even remotely touch on the amount of work you've done on religious artifacts. So if people wanted to learn more about your research into these topics specifically, which books should they pick up?
For the Shroud of Turin, my book, Inquest on the Shroud of Turin. But that book is old now, and even though it's been revised several times, it's still a little bit dated. The latest view is in, and you'd get the Blood of San Gennaro and many other cases, the True Cross, the Holy Grail, many of these other relics in my book, Relics of the Christ. And with any of my books, if you go to my website, joenickel.com, you can find the book you think you might like best. You click on it, and it'll take you to a place where you can get it. And remember my policy about buying my books. Anyone who buys one of my books becomes a friend. Anyone who buys two of my books becomes a close personal friend. And anyone who buys three or more of my books becomes an honorary family member and can come to my home at Thanksgiving. I won't be there, but they can make themselves at home on the porch or whatever we ask that they clean up. And yes, please buy my books. I worked hard to write them, and I hope they find them enlightening and will forgive any deficiencies.
I think you've done more than enough work to make up for any possible deficiencies. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And Joe Nickel writes for Skeptical Inquirer magazine as well, which you can visit at psicop.org/SI. That's psicop.org/SI. And after you check out Joe's work online, head to skepticallyspeaking.com. You can listen to archived episodes of our show, join the Facebook group, or follow us on Twitter, and also subscribe to the show in iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier. Reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring shell, gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.